Good day, everyone, and welcome to today's Advocates Respond to Program Rushing, the Review of Asylum Cases. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, you will have the opportunity to ask questions during the question-and-answer session. You may register to ask a question at any time by pressing the star and one on your touchtone phone. Please note this call may be recorded, and it is now my pleasure to turn the call over to Royce Murray. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Chris. Thanks, everyone, for joining us today. Reports have revealed a new government program being piloted in El Paso, which seeks to speed families through the asylum process. The program, called Prompt Asylum Case Review, or PACER as a shorthand, forces asylum seekers to have their interviews to determine whether they have a credible fear of persecution if returned to their home country while they're within Customs and Border Protection custody and without a meaningful chance to receive the assistance of an attorney to prepare. We have a great lineup of speakers for you today to further explain this process, what little we know about it, and the concerns that we all have. First, you'll be hearing from Taylor Levy, an independent El Paso-based immigration attorney. Then we'll turn it over to Linda Rivas, the Executive Director of Las Americas Advocacy Center in El Paso. Next, you'll hear from me, Royce Murray. I'm the Managing Director of Programs with the American Immigration Council. And then finally, we'll have Shaw Drake, Policy Counsel for the ACLU Border Rights Center, also based in El Paso. And with that, I will turn it over to Taylor Levy.
Good morning. Thank you for having me. As Royce was saying, PACER is a new program that has started in El Paso. It is something that was started without any announcement whatsoever. The legal community here was not told about it. The way we were able to find out about it actually was because I was contacted by an out-of-town attorney around October 9th. I was contacted by her because she was representing two sisters who were in Border Patrol custody here in El Paso. One of the sisters, Raquel, has a six-month-old child with her, six-month-old son, and Sylvia, who had a one-year-old daughter with her. They had crossed, and they were told that they needed to find attorneys within 48 hours, or they would be deported. That was the message that was relayed to their family. They found an attorney. The attorney had signed paperwork to represent them before they even actually crossed, and she spent the next 2 weeks trying to do everything possible to represent them and to help them, including reaching out to me multiple times. Once we figured out what was happening, I at first had told her, look, don't worry about it. This doesn't make sense. They're going to be transferred either to migrant protection protocols or they'll be transferred out of detention or be transferred to family detention. And this is what we expected to have happen. It turns out that this program PACER had started. We don't know when it started. I know that my two clients crossed on October 8th, but otherwise you'd have to get answers from DHS about when exactly this program started. What's going on, what happens under PACER, is that people, while they are still in Border Patrol custody, are given their credible fear interview to see if they can establish that first prong to be able to move forward with their asylum case and see a judge. Because of the asylum ban or the asylum transit ban, which says that you have to apply for asylum in other countries, if you've entered through Mexico, in every country that you've traveled through if you're not a Mexican, because of that, they're using a heightened standard for the credible fear interviews, which is similar to a reasonable fear interview. You have to prove a higher standard, a reasonable possibility that you'll be persecuted and that the government is unable and unwilling to protect you. This higher standard is more difficult to pass, and we believe that this is causing fewer people to be able to pass. You have the right to then choose to see an immigration judge for a negative credible fear review. My two clients did have that judicial review, but it was done telephonically. One of the main things that the clients are complaining about so much is that they had lots of printed proof with them that they brought when they crossed the border and turned themselves in to Border Patrol agents of the death threats and various threats and what they were fleeing in their home country, which is El Salvador. And they were never allowed to show that to anyone since everything was done telephonically. More than that, one of the biggest things that they are complaining about is the conditions during which they had to go through this whole process. They were held in the Border Patrol holding cells, so the hileras, in really horrific conditions. Raquel, with a six-month-old, was held for over 10 days in the holding cells, and then she said she had 1 day in the soft-sided facility after 10 days in the holding cells, and then was eventually transferred to two different motels before being deported. She was deported on October 21st, 14 days after arriving. She says during that entire time, she was allowed to shower 3 times. She was permitted to make only 2 phone calls the entire time, where she called her family member, who repeatedly told Border Patrol, please call the lawyer, please call the lawyer, here's the number. They tried to hire 2 different attorneys down here in El Paso, in addition to reaching out to me on a pro bono basis. That mother, Raquel, with the six-month-old, the day that she was deported to El Salvador, she took the child immediately to get emergency medical treatment, where he was treated with various respiratory treatments, including a nebulizer, a six-month-old baby, because he was so sick. He did not receive adequate health care. The other mother, the Sylvia, and her one-year-old daughter, she has been in detention for over 21 days now. The government has been telling the family that she'll be deported today, but they're still not sure. She and her daughter were separated from her husband and the father of the child. They haven't heard anything from him. What we're seeing from PACER more than anything is we're seeing that it appears to be a duck-duck-goose type of a program where they're arbitrarily picking which families are going to be placed into PACER versus being placed into the migrant protection protocols or released on recognizance with ankle bracelets into the home, into the community, which is obviously the best way to treat asylum-seeking families. We have a statement that we're willing to share with the press that we can send out afterwards from one of my clients, Raquel, the woman with the six-month-old baby. But I'm also going to read a brief portion of that statement, which we only have in Spanish. We haven't translated it, but the one English part of it that I'll read is that she says, she told me this morning that even though sleeping on the concrete floor with a thin blanket with her six-month-old baby was horrific, that the very worst thing that she endured was the psychological trauma from the way she was treated by Border Patrol. And she wrote in her statement, I feel tricked, humiliated, psychologically I am not well because of all of the racism, abuse of power, and humiliation that I received. There was a time that one of the agents treated me as if I was an idiot and said that I was not in my country. When referring to my baby, they would say things like, to whom does this thing belong? For this reason, I write all of this to make clear that if something happens to me, it is because the United States did not give me the opportunity to save the life of my child and my own, despite the fact that I had evidence. Today, I find myself in hiding in my own country because I'm afraid for my life and my child's. I believe my deportation was unfair, with trickery, and in a rushed manner. So thank you so much. I'll pass it back to Royce.
Thank you, Taylor, for that very detailed firsthand account. I'm going to turn it over now to Linda Rivas, Executive Director of Las Americas Advocacy Center in El Paso.
Thank you, Royce. Las Americas is a 32-year-old organization serving on the ground in El Paso, Texas. Here we have PACER, yet another pilot program that's being started in El Paso, Texas. As you all may know, El Paso was the test ground as well for family separation starting in July 2017, which was eventually ended by a federal court. Additionally, the Remain in Mexico or Migrant Protection Protocol program, while it did not roll out in El Paso first, it rolled out with the highest numbers. And we found ourselves as a community scrambling to be able to serve asylum seekers that were sent back to dangerous conditions. Las Americas is deeply concerned about PACER, the secrecy which it was started under, what rolled out under. We're a local and longstanding nonprofit agency. We provide legal services such as credible fear interview preparation for asylum seekers. So it is incredibly troubling for us to see this process being expedited in such a way that it is practically and logistically impossible to find an attorney. Las Americas and other nonprofits such as Catholic Charities of New Mexico and DMRS, the Diocesan Migrant and Refugee Services, we are often the first responders to these new and horrific DHS policies and programs. PACER completely undermines our role as legal advocates. Even as a nonprofit that services asylum seekers on both sides of the border now, and we've established a credible fear interview program that we coordinate mainly through pro bono attorneys, the idea that we would have to divert resources in order to serve families that that find themselves into the PACER program is, again, logistically impossible. We find ourselves constantly being forced to restructure and divert our resources by DHS. To this moment, none of the nonprofits on the ground have officially been told by CBP that this is something that they're doing, nor have we been asked to collaborate or even talked about access to counsel. We know at this time, it is our experience that in this custody, there is zero access to represent our clients while in CBP custody. We have been told that they cannot and will not physically accommodate attorneys. In our office, we have documented one phone call, which we are still haunted by because it was a family that was needing representation, and we did not have a lawyer or accredited representative available at the moment that CBP chose to call us, and the agent who spoke to one of our paralegals refused to call back when an attorney would be present. So as Las Americas, we remain committed to asylum seekers and fighting against these unjust systems that are created not to protect people, but instead to strip them of their rights. Thank you. I'll send it back to Royce.
Thank you, Linda. I want to take a moment. Again, this is Royce Murray with the American Immigration Council. I want to take a minute to express the council's profound concerns about the PACER process, that this, you know, rushed process is clearly designed to hastily deport people and encourage people to give up on their claims by holding them in CBP custody. We're focusing in part, and certainly in large part, on the problematic lack of access to counsel because we know it makes all the difference in the outcome of a case. And I want to share some data based on reports that the council has published in recent years. From a 2016 report by the American Immigration Council entitled Access to Counsel in Immigration Court, studied over 1 million deportation cases and found that immigrants with attorneys fare better at every stage of the court process. There were two key findings. One, represented immigrants were much more likely to apply for relief from deportation. In fact, detained immigrants were 11 times more likely to apply when they had representation, and that's simply because they understand the complex process better when they have someone to walk them through it. Second, represented immigrants were more likely to obtain the immigration relief they sought. Specifically, among detained immigrants, those with representation were twice as likely to obtain immigration relief. We all know the complexity of our immigration and asylum laws, and for someone to succeed without an attorney becomes virtually impossible. And so we know that this rushed process, which while kept in CBP custody, as Linda was saying, makes the access to counsel logistically impossible. I also want to note that holding people in custody during their immigration court proceedings is based on the faulty premise that people will flee if they are released. Another Immigration Council report from 2018 called Detaining Families looked at 15 years of data and found that 96% of asylum-seeking families attended all of their court hearings. So as Taylor Levy mentioned during her remarks, what we need to see is having people released with appropriate case management services for the duration of their immigration court proceedings, and we will see people turning up in court and getting better access to counsel. With that, I will turn it over to Shaw Drake, who is policy counsel at the ACLU Border Rights Center in El Paso. Before I do that, I do want to note that we have had longstanding concerns about CBP conditions. This is not a new issue. CBP has a long track record of providing inadequate conditions and medical care. And I'll just refer those of you on the call to the litigation that we filed along with the ACLU of Arizona and other organizations back in 2015 called Doe v. Nielsen that is litigating the conditions in the Tucson sector of Border Patrol and how woefully problematic they have been. That case goes to trial in January. And I'll also note that just last month, the American Immigration Council and the American Immigration Lawyers Association filed an administrative complaint with the FBI and DHS oversight agencies to call for an investigation into inadequate medical care in CBP custody, addressing some of the kinds of issues that Taylor mentioned in her remarks, especially for young children. And those include 9 firsthand accounts of people who had problematic care. So with that, I turn it over to Shaw Drake to further discuss problematic conditions.
Thank you so much, Royce. So this is yet another example of Border Patrol carrying out an abusive pilot project in secret outside the view of Congress, the American people, and the legal community. The facts as we understand them indicate that Border Patrol is fast-tracking deportations while holding migrants nearly wholly incommunicado at one of their notorious black hole detention facilities where no one has access to ensure the fair and humane treatment of those held there. Given Border Patrol's track record of abuse, including the deaths of children in their custody, the last thing that this agency should be allowed to do is shove migrants through a life or death decision-making process devoid of protection. And it's important to remember that CBP has an extremely long history of subjecting migrants to deplorable and abusive conditions. Just within the last year, we at the ACLU have filed complaints with the Department of Homeland Security Office of Inspector General regarding conditions at Border Patrol stations here in El Paso as well as in the Rio Grande Valley, where many migrants were forced to sleep on muddy, rocky ground and in puddles of water during thunderstorms, which was followed by extreme heat, humidity, and sun exposure. Some of those families included children, and they were not provided bedding or mats or chairs when kept indoors or in the outdoor facilities. Reports also included consistent sleep deprivation for multiple days in custody, lack of medical examination and treatment, lack of food and water, and verbal abuse and threats by Border Patrol agents. In one case, agents made fun of one man's speech impediment and held the man and his 10-year-old son for 7 days. The OIG later, conducting their own investigations, found dangerous conditions in those CBP facilities, including facilities here in the El Paso sector, and focused their findings on extreme overcrowding and the prolonged detention of migrants in those facilities. We cannot forget that at least 12 migrants have died in CBP custody just in the last year, including multiple children. Notably, there had not been a single death of a child in over a decade in those facilities. Members of Congress have visited the border and toured detention facilities, yet funding for CBP has continued and even increased without adequate protections to prevent abusive conditions. The ACLU, along with partners, have obtained and released over 30,000 pages of documents dating back to 2009 that describes a shocking violence and abuse against migrant children in CBP custody. Those documents detail federal officials verbally, physically, and sexually assaulting migrant children. The documents also demonstrate that U.S. officials were aware of these abuses as they occurred, but failed to properly investigate and much less remedy them. So CBP and Congress have failed to implement any meaningful changes to policy or adopt adequate measures that would help prevent this type of abusive conditions and treatments from reoccurring. Not only are few protections in place, the agency is now shoving asylum seekers through expedited removal procedures inside these facilities with zero oversight or transparency. I'll leave it in that and turn it back to Royce. Thank you.
Thank you, Shaw. Chris, our operator, can you help us with logistics for opening up the line for questions?
Certainly. At this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press star and 1 on your touch-tone phone. You may withdraw yourself from the question queue at any time by pressing the pound key. Once again, to ask a question, please press star 1 now. And our first question comes from Julio Chavez from Reuters. Please go ahead.
Hi, I just wanted to check. I know this is something that Linda Rivas touched on, but have you guys been able to confirm through anything outside of the Washington Post reporting about the name, the purpose of the PACER program?
Thank you, Julio. Taylor, do you, since you were mentioned in that Washington Post article, do you want to say what you know or others?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the last thing he said. What we know about Could you repeat the question?
The name
I didn't hear
purpose.
The last words.
Yes, I was wondering if you guys have been able to confirm the information contained in the Washington Post reporting outside of reading the actual story.
Unfortunately, no. The program has been shrouded in lots of secrecy. I went physically a week ago on Monday to try and speak to my clients in Border Patrol Station 1. I asked repeatedly about PACER because I had heard about PACER from Veronica Escobar's office, that they had heard about the program, and I had permission to say that, you know, they had heard about it. And I asked them repeatedly if they would tell me if my clients were in PACER, and they said they could not confirm or deny that. All they said that was that, you know, have patience with us, things are new, et cetera. And I was like, okay, so they are in PACER then, and they said that they wouldn't confirm that. I was not allowed to see my clients in person. Turns out one of them had already been removed that same day. I found out later, but I was allowed a phone call finally after speaking to lots of supervisors for about 10 minutes while a Border Patrol agent was sitting right next to her.
Thank you. Linda or Shaw, did you have anything to add on the acknowledgement of the program or further details than was mentioned?
This is Linda. I will say that the Border Patrol agent who called our office, our paralegal, they did say it was a new program. They did not necessarily call it PACER at the time. They said that they needed a family to have immediate legal representation, which, you know, at the time, again, impossible for us to do in that moment. Very unfortunate, but the most concerning part here is we have not received any official word from Border Patrol, and it seems to be purposeful that they have not told the NGOs what's going on.
And Julio, this is Royce. I would just note, at least broadly in the there's a CBS story by Camila Montoya Galvez that does include on-the-record remarks from DHS. I don't know that they acknowledge the name of the program, but they certainly acknowledge its function and existence. Okay, Chris, can we go to the next question?
And our next question comes from Maria Pina from Telemundo. Please go ahead.
Yes. Thank you for doing this call. This is a little bit unrelated, but I was wondering if you have any updated information on, one, whether or not family separation is still occurring, and two, what has the government done to reunite the kids that remain separated, you know, in light of that report that came out last week that more children were separated than previously thought. So your thoughts on that, because I'm giving up on the press office at DHS. They're not responding in a timely fashion or giving any information at all. Thank you.
Thank you. I don't know if Linda or Taylor want to speak to family separation in El Paso or Shaw. If there's more you want to say, obviously the prevailing litigation on family separation is being done by the ACLU.
No, I have no further comment at this time, but you can certainly reach out to our media team at media@aclu.org, and they will direct you to the right person on our organization to comment about the ongoing litigation on family separation.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
Taylor or Linda, is there anything you wanted to add in, regarding family separation that you've observed in El Paso?
This is Taylor. I don't really think I have anything too helpful to add other than we have seen family separation in MPP. I've represented three cases of family separation where the biological parents of biological children were sent back under the migrant protection protocols and their children were placed into OR custody. All of those have since been reunited thanks to very large legal teams working on the cases. So we know that there's more cases than what we've seen happening because we obviously don't get to every case. So it's an ongoing problem.
Thank you, Taylor. Chris, are there additional questions?
There are, but once again, I would like to remind everyone that it is star and one to join the question queue. Our next question comes from Elliot Spigot from Associated Press. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Before I ask my question, I wanted to ask Taylor, you were referring to clients. Is that the same two women? You had said another attorney contacted you and you referred to them as your clients. Is that the same people?
Yes, we're co-counseling on the case.
Okay, got it.
Because that attorney was out of town and I'm here locally.
Right.
But yeah, the other attorney, Myra, who's in the Washington Post article, she is the primary attorney on the case, but then she asked for my help here on the ground.
Got it. I'm just really trying to understand how this program, this pilot, is different from the existing arrangements. You've mentioned that it's all on CBP facilities, but turning first to the turnaround time, the Post story said that the goal is to have the credible fear interview within one day and have the negative credible fear finding review with the judge within 10 days. Do you have anything on that? Do you know how, if that's true, if there's a target date for completion, and if so, how it differs from what is currently in place?
Taylor, would you like to answer that? Or Linda, if you have any additional information?
Elliot, we don't have any confirmation whatsoever from DHS, so I don't know.
Okay.
Whatever they're telling the reporters is what we know as well. I will say what it differs is in MPP, Remain in Mexico, there are no credible fear interviews. Instead, they skip that step and put people directly into proceedings so they will be allowed to see a judge. The difference with this program is that they go through the credible fear interview, which is what happens to people when they're in ICE custody, such as single adults. Credible fear interviews rarely in the El Paso area take place any quicker than a week to 2 weeks upon placement in custody. I have one client, for example, who crossed a week ago, a single female, and she's still pending her credible fear interview. When I wrote the office yesterday to ask to make sure that I'll be there for the interview, they told me it's not even in their queue for scheduling yet. So it usually takes a couple weeks is what we see. So it gives people more time to be able to find lawyers. And when they're in ICE custody, whether it's family detention custody or single adult custody, they have access to Know Your Rights presentations, to attorney visitation in person, to, you know, phone calls so they can call their family whenever they want, I mean, as long as they can pay for it, et cetera, et cetera. So it is a very broad difference. Even had we been able to access this facility, talk to people in person, et cetera, it's pretty impossible logistically for anyone, even if they can afford it, to get legal representation within 48 hours. That's what my clients were told, that their interview did occur within 48 hours as well. And so these were two clients who had money. They had an attorney. They could pay for an attorney. They were doing everything possible. It wasn't just a case of, you know, the nonprofits being too busy.
So just to make sure I understand the difference on attorney access with this program and the normal arrangement, normally you would be allowed into the ICE detention facility for the credible fear interview, correct me if I'm wrong, or at least the review. And with this, it sounds like you're not allowed any access or like zero, although you did mention, Taylor, that you had a phone call, but it sounds like it's basically zero. Is that right?
Yeah, we're not allowed any physical access whatsoever, and we're allowed telephonic access, but we've asked for clarity on what's the process to get telephonic access, because what I did was, you know, complain to a lot of supervisors and show up unannounced and demand access, which is not obviously a sustainable process. They haven't given us any feedback of how we can actually gain access, as opposed to in ICE custody, we have access.
Okay. Normally, you're allowed to attend the review. What's the normal arrangement?
Yes, normally we can attend the reviews in person.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Elliot. Chris, are there additional questions?
And it does appear there are no further questions over the phone at this time.
Okay. Well, if there are no further questions, I want to thank everyone for joining us today. You can certainly follow up with any of us after this call for further information, for additional resources that were mentioned, whether it be the statement from Taylor's client that was mentioned. There were studies that were cited, litigation that was cited. So we are happy to provide those links if there's any follow-up questions after the call. But thank you again for your attention to this troubling new process, and we look forward to hearing from you.